Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. With the second session of this year's Congress convening, lawmakers are facing a lengthy list of environmental bills due for renewal, among others, clean water, energy, and endangered species. We'll have a preview. Also this time, scientists and inventors, concerned citizens from coast to coast are busy exploring alternate energy sources. On the East Coast, a new kind of heat pump. Meanwhile in Texas, harnessing the motion of the ocean with a device called a toroid.
These things continuously are bobbing and moving, and all of this movement is captured and created into spinning motion on this shaft and so forth that's in the top of the thing.
We'll talk with Dallas inventor Bill Eberle. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Jobs, 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 the rallying cry of the presidential campaign for Democrats and Republicans, say those in charge of selling the candidates. In truth, though, the economy is the dominant topic, whether on Capitol Hill, in cabinet-level meetings, or in our living rooms. Having to cope with these pressing domestic issues and the ever-changing world of international politics, it hardly seems likely, then, that Congress will find time to look over its various pieces of pending environmental legislation. Yet look them over it must, as some are due for renewal this year. To get one perspective on the action ahead, we called upon David Gardner, legislative director for the Sierra Club in Washington. Says Gardner, Congress has some unfinished business in the form of the Johnston-Wallop Senate energy bill defeated last fall in a filibuster. He says he expects some renewed work on that.
It remains to be seen whether an energy strategy, which would be primarily based on improving the energy efficiency and making substantial improvements in energy conservation and in production of renewable energy, could emerge from the Congress in 1992.
So there isn't any guarantee, then, that any kind of bill will be taken up, particularly in this presidential election year?
No, there's no guarantee, and it's clear that there are many interests, particularly the energy companies themselves, who will be lobbying for all the wrong things. The oil companies, for example, will continue their efforts to try to force the government to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska for oil and gas drilling. And that obviously would be extremely destructive. It's a bad proposal, not only in terms of the environment, but really very short-sighted in terms of our future energy strategy as well. But it's a good example of the kinds of special interests that are lobbying hard here in Washington to try to tilt the energy strategy to be good for oil companies and the like, and bad for the American public.
The list of new business is quite lengthy, too. Slated for renewal this year is the Clean Water Act, a bill Gardner calls the cornerstone of environmental protection laws in the United States. Particularly contentious is that section dealing with wetlands.
The Bush administration has proposed a measure that would substantially weaken the protection of wetlands in this country, and they have not finalized that proposal, but I believe Congress will be, and the public will be waiting to see what the Bush administration does on this critical wetland protection rule. Once the administration has made its decision, I expect that Congress will begin to take up the whole discussion of what to do with wetlands and the rest of the federal Clean Water Act.
Gardner says strengthening our commitment to preserving the nation's wetlands should be the primary goal of a renewed Clean Water Act.
And the second plank is that we need to take on toxic pollutants in a more serious way than we have. Our goal as a nation needs to be this complete elimination of toxic pollution into our rivers, streams, and lake. And I would argue that that would be the second most important part of a renewed Clean Water Act.
Also due for reauthorization this year is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Better known as RCRA, this bill, says Gardner, is the fundamental law regulating not only our disposal of wastes, but how they are generated in the first place.
I think that there's no question that the American public has clearly seen that we are producing too much garbage and too much waste in this country, and that we need to be more aggressive than we currently have been in terms of promoting recycling programs. We need to steer away from environmentally destructive technologies, disposal technologies like dumps and incinerators, and instead try to put pressure on companies that manufacture products to make sure that they have small amounts of packaging and packaging which is capable of being recycled, and that that material get recycled in an aggressive way.
We can expect intense debate as well over reauthorizing the Endangered Species Act, with lines of disagreement drawn between protection of endangered species and protection of jobs. Says Gardner, nowhere is this better illustrated than in the virgin forests of the Pacific Northwest, home of the northern spotted owl.
The Bush administration is currently developing a plan to protect those forests. We don't know yet whether that plan will do the job or not, and we would expect that, regardless of whether the plan is good or not, that the Congress will want to discuss that plan and may, in fact, decide to either change it or push it forward. But if we are going to, we must protect these virgin forests in the Pacific Northwest, which are the habitat not only to the spotted owl, but to many endangered species. And we want to preserve and protect this small piece of America's heritage for future generations, and 1992 is going to be the opportunity to do that.
The other major challenge facing not so much Congress, but the Bush administration, is preparing for the June Environment Summit in Rio de Janeiro. Gardner says President Bush not only needs to attend the meeting, the president needs to assume a leadership role. Overall, says Gardner,
well, I'm always optimistic about the prospects for environmental legislation during an election year, because elections have a funny way of making elected officials much more responsive to the interests of the public. And since the public is such a strong advocate for stronger environmental protections, I think the prospects overall for the environment in 1992 look good.
David Gardner, legislative director for the Sierra Club in Washington. And this is Bruce Robertson.
This filter, okay, which is the return side of the unit. Air is being pulled through this blower, okay? All right? It's picking
Thomas
up
O'Connell
heat
peers
in this
through
coil.
A glass window at plastic tubes and rotating fans as he describes how a geothermal heat pump works. It is actually a demonstration unit in his office. What is missing is the geothermal part, or heat from the earth. An engineering researcher in the 1970s, O'Connell heard about heat pumps used in Sweden, which converted heat from the earth into heat for the home. The two major oil embargoes of the 1970s further drew his attention to the dwindling supply of world oil. He took a closer look at geothermal energy.
Being a researcher, I was working for Bell Labs at the time, I decided that I was going to actively work in the area of alternative energy and see if I could use my ingenuity to find a solution. It took me many years and a lot of thinking and reading and so on, and I actually looked at all the areas of alternative energy, solar, wind, hydro, and so on, and then came upon the concept of getting heat from the earth and simply looked at what existed in the industry, which at that time was relatively primitive, and found an area where I thought I could make a contribution.
Now, O'Connell holds two patents that make the Swedish concept more efficient. He is a computer science professor at Siena College, but his alternative fuel research happens at Geotech, a company he founded in nearby Troy, New York. There, he designs heat pumps which extract energy from the ground about 25 feet below the surface.
The heat in the earth is available year-round. And if you go vertically, that is, drill a borehole, it's going to be a relatively constant temperature. So we put a collector underground by simply drilling a hole, inserting a U-tube, which is a polyethylene tubing material, and then circulate a fluid in that tube, picking up the natural heat in the New York State area that averages about 50 degrees in the wintertime and 50 degrees in the summer. So we can transfer that heat in through a heat pump, which is able to amplify it thermally to about 75 or 80 degrees. And we'll pretend again that the homeowner is trying to seek comfort in the wintertime, okay? And in this case, what we're doing is we're taking energy from the ground.
Underground pipes carry the heated fluid, usually water, into the basement of the building and then into the heat pump itself. there, the heat is absorbed by a refrigerant, which is then compressed, increasing pressure, causing the temperature to rise. When that heated refrigerant is released into a coil, it cools off, producing heat. A fan then blows that heat into the ducts, which in turn heat the building. O'Connell says the underground system is more efficient than traditional heat pumps, which use energy from the air outside.
In traditional heat pumps, the main problem is that as the source of energy, which is the air, drops in temperature, it becomes a less effective medium to extract energy from. And so, for example, on a zero-degree day, a heat pump is not really able to take sufficient energy from the air to provide comfort to the space. In addition, the compressor, which is outside, is working in a fairly hostile temperature range and needs to have some additional hardening and other kinds of modes of operation to make sure it's protected. And so there's some strain and stress on equipment at those low temperatures. Normally what happens then is because of this, a lot of electric heat has to come on to support the heating requirement of the household.
So when the weather gets cold, traditional heat pumps have to work harder to convert the cold air outside to heat inside. That means more electricity is used by the fan and compressor, and sometimes electric heat has to be used to make up for the pump's inefficiency. On a zero-degree day, O'Connell says, an air source heat pump uses 2 to 3 times more electricity than a geothermal pump. But O'Connell says electricity is not the only thing conserved.
We have several areas which are significant. One is conservation and the protection to the environment go hand in hand. The less energy you consume, the more likely you're going to protect that ozone layer. That's just a direct relationship. In addition, we have conservation in terms of the tremendous first cost of building new power generating facilities and the impact in the environment of just building one of those. That's going in our favor. Conservation in terms of simply saving money. People really are tired of paying high bills just to stay warm and or to be cool. And so we're finding ways to deliver a device that can do that.
O'Connell points out advantages over other heating systems. Oil, for instance, must be transported over long distances. Any combustion adds pollutants to the atmosphere. But more importantly, other sources like coal, oil, and gas come from a finite source. Yet this system is not free of pollutants. Freon, a substance which contributes to global warming and ozone depletion, is the refrigerant used. But O'Connell argues the substance is safer in the geothermal unit than in the traditional heat pump.
The factory has the ability to totally seal the system. A refrigerator is a good example. It's a factory-sealed system, okay? Refrigerators, by and large, don't leak refrigerant and are not a real threat to this environment, okay? On the other hand, systems that have to be put together in the field, there is some reasonable risk that some refrigerant can escape during the process of charging the system, okay? You don't have any control over the technician, and in some cases, things can happen.
O'Connell says leakage is possible from a traditional pump because it is assembled and the refrigerant injected on site. But perhaps the biggest advantage of geothermal systems is the price. O'Connell estimates installation in the average house costs less than $10,000, followed by a 30 to 60% decrease in heating costs. Right now, the company which sells the geothermal pumps, Water Furnace, reports sales of 20 to 30,000 systems a year across North America. Though he hopes this means a project with many false starts is finally off the ground, O'Connell says there is plenty of work left.
I'd like to think I've made a dent. I certainly am genuine in my interest, and I think I have personally made an impact. But I still see a lot of work to be done. There's still a lot of information that needs to get out into the public. There's certainly a lot more systems that have to be installed to start making a real impact in terms of the energy outlook in New York State, New Jersey, and in the broader sense, nationally.
O'Connell recently received a $700,000 grant from the state of New York to work on a 100% geothermal system, which will use no electricity, either for the fan and compressor or for backup heating. He is also working with Stockton College in New Jersey, considering converting to the geothermal system. On top of that, there are three more patents also being considered. Thomas O'Connell is a computer science professor at Siena College and founder of Geotech. The challenge may sound overwhelming, but he says if there is a better, safer way to provide energy, he will not rest until he finds it. And this is Bruce Robertson.
Heat in this coil. In this case, it is truly heating, so it's picking up heat. The refrigerant is liquefying as it's giving off the heat. Okay.
The mesmerizing, rocking motion of the ocean has inspired all those who have ever come down to the sea. A motion that existed long before even the ancient Greeks plied the wine-dark seas, a motion that will exist long after you and I walk the shores today. For Bill Eberle, though, it wasn't myth, legend, or romance that drew him to seaside. It was the prospect of energy, motion of the ocean energy. Before we talk to Mr. Eberle, we should tell you, MOTO is not yet in operation anywhere. It is an idea, a blueprint, a plan. Though we have seen a video artist's depiction of what such an operation would look like. So, from his Dallas, Texas headquarters, Eberle takes us to a fictitious coastal site where, standing on an imaginary bluff overlooking an intangible bay, we look out at a MOTO installation.
Basically, what you'd be looking at would be a bunch of things that would appear like posts sticking up out of the water, around which were displayed donut-shaped floats. We call them toroids because that's a geometrical design word that describes a circle that goes around and meets itself like a donut. And you would see these things bobbing up and down around the pilaster or post, if you will. And what this thing is doing is these bob up and down. They're the tremendous force that's generated by these great big donuts going up and down is driving an air compressor.
The rising and falling motion of this donut, or toroid, actually performs three tasks, which we will describe in just a moment. To reiterate, what we are looking at here from our fictitious vantage point is a series of installations partially submerged in the water. Perhaps you might visualize a concrete pillar of a bridge. Around each pillar, Eberle calls it a pilaster, is what looks like a huge, round life preserver. This circular device basically floats with the waves, rising with the ebb and falling with the flow, in a constant motion, up and down. But how does this do anything but ride the ocean swell? Well, Eberle explains.
The donut is built to where it can freely move up and down around this pilaster, and then it's connected the engine portions of it that are up in the top with a rack and pinion arrangement. A rack being a long piece that has gear teeth on one side, and then the pinion being a round gear that's on a shaft up in the top of the thing. And as this thing goes up or down, either one, it captures the force by using left and right-hand clutches. It captures this force and creates it into a spinning motion on a giant shaft with big flywheels on it to make it run smooth. And any motion of the ocean, it can be waves, it can be... The tides, of course, only happen four times a day, so you don't get a whole lot out of them, but it's designed where it can operate at high tide or low tide, and it can withstand anything up to a king-size hurricane and or typhoon, and if something like that should occur, it's designed to open seacocks automatically and sink below the surface and help support the rest of the structure until the storm is over, and then it can easily be brought back up again and put back in service. And if you were to throw a cork or any you take a small boat and go out in the ocean, you'll notice that this boat never holds still. It's always bobbing up and down and moving this way and that way and so forth. Well, all of these forces are harnessed by this toroid. No matter what direction the water is coming at it, if the water is a little bit higher than it was a split second ago, well, now this thing rises. And as soon as the water's a little bit lower, which it continuously is, one or the other, with the waves and the ground swells and that sort of thing, these things continuously are bobbing and moving. And all of this movement is captured and created into spinning motion on this shaft and so forth that's in the top of the thing.
Okay, so we have motion now, almost a perpetual motion machine. What do we do with this motion? Well, earlier we mentioned three possible uses, one being to drive an air compressor. Eberle says in this case, the entire toroid itself would become the storage tank, like a hollow donut. The air would be then piped ashore.
And on shore, they can be driving they can use this compressed air to drive an electricity-producing generator and turbine combination. In some cases, it could be a power plant that had formerly been driven by steam from a boiler system, burning fossil fuel or whatever other method that they might have had. Most of them are either oil or coal-fired, and they have a boiler, and all the problems of keeping the boiler working and getting up steam and all that sort of thing. And the turbines really don't care what blows on them as long as something does. And so this vast array of big donuts out there can hold a tremendous amount of pressure. They're capable of being pressurized up to 500 PSI, while the turbine runs very well on 100 PSI. So they act as load-leveling devices that allow you to have a bountiful supply and a constant performance of the turbines or generators or whatever.
The tremendous horsepower created by the bobbing toroid could also be used to pump seawater ashore to desalination facilities. The pumps run by fossil fuels in conventional plants being one of the most expensive elements in making fresh water from salt water. Finally, says Eberle, the MOTO unit could power a direct current generator, DC generator, to conduct electrolysis, splitting water, H2O, into its constituent components, oxygen and hydrogen, one of the alternate fuels of the future. The primary use, however, would be to generate electricity.
Actually, each one of these post-looking things with a donut around it would probably create on an average of 1 megawatt each, which is 1 million watts. Now, a basic installation, you can't just put one of them out there. You have to have at least three so that they, with the catwalks tying them together, they become well braced in every direction so they can stand the high forces that happen out in the ocean. But after the first basic installation of three, which would produce about 3 megawatts, then you can add them one at a time because each new one you add creates another triangle when you put the catwalks on it.
Earlier we said this concept is just that, a theory of Bill Eberle's. This is not quite accurate. First of all, the idea of harnessing the ocean waves has been around for a while, and France, England, China, Norway, and Canada have been successful in designing variations on this technology, with varying degrees of success. And secondly, Eberle has in fact seen something of his idea at work.
We built a very small prototype, about a tenth of the actual size, and instead of building a complete array where we could put it in the ocean or in a big body of water, we only made it, instead of 30 feet across, the donut is only 3 feet across, and the pilaster in the central post, instead of being 8 feet, is only 1 foot. And we put it in a swimming pool. And with my grandchildren and my children diving in the pool to create waves, we were able to light up our backyard.
Eberle says the units could be camouflaged in such a way as to be barely noticeable. And to function properly, the units would be in water at least 20 feet deep, thus necessitating some distance offshore. In other words, from our mythical bluff overlooking the bay, we would not be able to see very much. Countering possible objections that the pilasters would disrupt the marine ecosystem on the ocean floor, Eberle points out the curious irony that oil rig platforms have long been known to provide a reef-like habitat for marine plants, fish, and shellfish. Former Navy diver Bill Eberle is chief executive officer of Eberle Energy Enterprises, Incorporated, and he spoke to us from company headquarters in Dallas, Texas. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show for this week. Our piece on heat pumps was written and produced by Karen Kelly. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Be sure to ask for the Environment Show, this week number 108. The number once again, 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 108. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.